When I was preparing for the ministry, I had to work as a chaplain in a hospital for a summer. I spent about half that time in direct contact with patients and their loved ones, and the other half meeting with my group, because this wasn't a solitary experience. I was learning to provide spiritual care with five other chaplain interns and a supervisor, a group that was really diverse in race and in age and in gender and in faith tradition. There was Julian, a young African-American man of the United Church of Christ, who grew up Baptist in the depressed and violent south suburbs of Chicago. Julian was intelligent and articulate and passionate about youth ministry and working to end violence and poverty in his city. He shared my love of good Southern cooking and affirmed my growing understanding of the need for all humans to join in justice work. Gina was a young woman who, like me, had just finished her first year of seminary. She was hesitant and questioning, but full of grace and compassion, an ELCA Lutheran who, in her own words, didn't fit in the box. Gina and I shared long, discerning conversations, and she gave me the gift of knowing that my perspective can help others as they ask some of the big questions about themselves and their faith. Robert was an Augustinian Catholic, also finishing his first year of seminary, a 30-ish man who was gentle and kind and accepting. Robert and I shared a dry and sometimes dark sense of humor, and he once spoke with me about feeling surrounded in God's love. And when I asked, he actually explained what that experience was like, giving me access to it on a visceral level. Fred was an ordained Pentecostal minister in his 40s, a native Liberian with strong fundamentalist Christian beliefs and very strongly vocal opinions on what is right and wrong in culture and society. Fred gave me the experience of having to stretch myself towards someone utterly unlike myself to affirm the inherent worth and dignity of the other. And Kifa, a fundamentalist Muslim woman in her mid-40s who applied to the program because she felt called by Allah to do healing work, a woman of strong empathy and caring. Kifa and I shared a deep love of family, and she led me kicking and screaming to learn to recognize my own educational arrogance and helped me begin to let go of my need to be right. And Phyllis, our supervisor, a Jewish woman in her 60s, who approached her faith in both scholarly and mystical ways, who welcomed me as an ally in the highly Christocentric environment of the hospital. We spent 7 weeks together sharing the work and the deep learning that comes from walking with people who are facing death and people who are recovering, people whose children are ill, people who have been in serious accidents or have been shot. We spent half our time building trust with those people, helping them find a way through what it was they were dealing with. And we spent half our time building trust with each other. Joined in the common cause of learning to meet patients and their loved ones where they were and journeying with them for a time, the seven of us were able to reach past some of the issues that so often separate those of different faiths. And let me tell you, sometimes that was hard work. But we found a universal language that had nothing to do with our separate faiths and cultures. In our group sessions and in our personal conversations, we walked the holy ground of finding commonality and trust, and then learning to use that experience to find ways to provide care, spiritual care, to patients and their loved ones. For example, when I offered my group my theology of connection, which is this understanding of mine, this spiritual expression of my scientific understanding of physical and energy connection between all living things and everything that surrounds them, every one of these amazing people said, "Yes, yes, I know that, I feel that." The difference is The difference was, this connection is where I find what I call God. And they had a God that lived outside that concept. We each had our own ways of coming to that centering moment that Dr. Thurman describes in this morning's wisdom. Prayer, meditation, movement, private or shared reflection. And then we moved out of that moment to make meaning and take action based on what we found there. Dr. Thurman wrote, "It does seem to be a luxury to be able to give thought and time to the ups and downs of one's private journey while the world around is so sick and weary and desperate." This describes another thing we had to learn how to trust, that it was important for each of us to do our inner work, right? So that we could serve each other and serve those we were there to serve. Dr. Thurman modeled a way toward that trust, deep conversation with the God of his heart and his understanding to grapple with the hard questions he faced. Despite my lack of belief in that God, I can see in his prayer two practices that can move me into trust: openness and gratitude. Dr. King and the children we heard about in our message found that trust too, although perhaps in different ways. Dr. King was rooted, deeply rooted, in the Christian faith, which was described by a UU minister who interviewed Coretta Scott King in 2002 as a faith in a suffering God who stood with suffering people despite their mistakes and failures, and covenantal love between himself and oppressed African Americans, the people who grounded his passion for justice but did not restrict it solely to themselves. Dr. King had to trust in that God and his relationship with that God to be able to move himself and the people who trusted him into danger in the streets of the segregated South. And for the children of Birmingham to see themselves as akin to the Hebrews escaping the Pharaoh took a phenomenal leap of faith and trust in the better nature of those police officers. The book of Proverbs in the Hebrew scriptures tells us, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, submit to him, and he will make your path straight." This is what both Dr. King and Moses did in order to lead their people into freedom. And I know this kind of trust and this kind of language pushes all kinds of buttons for Unitarian Universalists and other liberal thinkers. There's a theological conundrum here for people who don't believe in that God. In what do we trust, then, with all our hearts? Because there has to be something. What understandings do we have that we should put aside in favor of submitting to something else? Do we need to have our paths made straight? What does that even mean? I'm not going to tell you. We get to think about that together. I am going to tell you another story, though. I think the story of Nachshon can bring another lens to this conversation. The story is a midrash, a commentary on the Torah by early rabbis that fills in some of the holes of the original stories. So this particular midrash fills in the story of the parting of the Red Sea. The Israelites come to the sea and become afraid because they are trapped, and Moses stops to pray for guidance. And while God is telling him to raise his staff and part the water, Nachshon, the prince of Judah, one of the tribes, comes to believe that action is more important than fear. And he walks into the water. Moses sees him, and he hurries over, and he raises his staff as God had told him to do, just as Nachshon is almost completely submerged. And the waters part then, and the Israelites escape from the Pharaoh's army. Stacy Zizuk Robinson, a member of the Reformed Jewish community, tells the story in a way that creates a new definition of trust. She writes, "Nachson was a slave with all the other Israelites who found redemption at the hand of God. He was let go with a capital L and a capital G, brought out with a mighty hand. He packed and he didn't let the dough rise, and he ran, breathless and scared and grateful, away from the land of pharaohs and pyramids and slavery. Nachson ran into freedom. And then he got to the sea. He and some 600,000 other unslaved people stopped cold by the Red Sea. It was huge and liquid and deep, and they couldn't see the other side. It was so big they couldn't see any sides, just wetness from here to forever. And behind him, when he and the 600,000 others dared to peek, were Pharaoh and his army of men and horses and chariots carrying spears and swords and assorted sharp, pointy things. Even at a distance, the sharp, pointy things loomed quite large in the eyes of Nachson and his recently freed landsmen. They were caught between the original rock and hard place, or between water and sharp, pointy things. And at that point, I don't think anyone involved cared much about getting the metaphor exactly right. What they cared about was getting out from that perilous middle and fast." She continues, "So Moses went to have a chat with God. And just like that, he got an answer. All the children of Israel needed to do was walk forward into the sea, that big, wet, deep, forever sea. God would provide a way. Trust me, God seemed to say. I got you this far, didn't I? I wouldn't let you fall now." Nachson and the 600,000 stood at the shivery edge of that sea, staring at that infinite horizon in front and the pointy, roiling chaos of death and slavery behind them. They stood planted, and let's face it, not just planted, but rooted in their fear and their mistrust and their doubt. They may have felt assured by the presence of God as a pillar of smoke or fire, but the soldiers and the sea were there, present and real. And then in the midst of that fear and doubt, something changed. Nachson, recently freed, trapped between death by water and death by bleeding, did the miraculous. He put one foot in front of the other and he walked into the sea. The 600,000 held their collective breath, watching the scene unfold before them as Nachson did what they could not do. He decided to have faith. And though the water first covered his ankles and then his knees, he kept walking. And then his chest, and then kept rising until he was swallowed whole. He still kept walking and kept believing. And just when it seemed that he was a fool for his faith, that he would surely drown in that infinite sea, another miracle. The waters parted. The sea split, and Nachson, so recently over his head, walked on dry land. The 600,000 breathed again, in one relieved whoosh of air, and they found their own faith and followed Nachson into the dry sea to across to the other side. And then the journey truly began. Hello. I hear openness here and gratitude. Ms. Robinson tells us that Nachson decided to have faith. That blows me away. I think of it more like he opened the way to possibility. He walked into the sea while Moses was busy talking with God about whether he could part the waters, and the waters didn't part until he was in so deep that his nose was covered and he couldn't breathe. And then the journey truly began, because trust had been brought into the room. This is what I mean when I call us people of faith. I mean that we're like Nachson, prone to trust, willing and able to hold our hearts open to the possibilities within and around us, and willing to venture into what we find in that openness. This is part of our Unitarian Universalist theology and our heritage. We're part of a tradition that understands itself as ever-changing, as ever-evolving with new stories and new interpretations and new experiences and new discoveries. Revelation is not sealed. And openness is an intrinsic and inseparable and completely necessary part of that understanding of ourselves. And gratitude, for me, is a door to that kind of openness and a consequence of it. So a practice of gratitude can bring me to more openness, and that openness can bring me to a practice of gratitude. This is why I pray the way I pray. I say, wow, thank you, and please. I first noticed this cycle in my group of chaplain interns, and despite our theological differences, we all practiced it. Stacy Robinson ends her story with these words, "I pray to have faith enough to walk into my own sea of doubt and fear and darkness. I want to walk and feel the waters part, to be released from the tangled web of thought that holds me immobile and disconnected. I have learned again and again without fail, when I take that step, when I find the faith to put one foot in front of the other and to trust, as Nachson did, I am carried forward. I am freed from my self-imposed bondage. I am enough, and I can walk again on dry land to freedom." I preach the same thing every week. I don't know if you've caught on yet, but... But it feels so true, because this is what we do here together. This is what we practice here together. We practice taking that first step. We look into each other's eyes, and we say, I trust you to hold this with me. And that is the trust that will save us. May it be so, and may we be so.